VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hello, Ruckers. Look at this. We're back for a little midweek treat for you, a special pod with two top draw captains, leaders and legends turned Times columnists to take a trip down memory lane, because the annual Calcutta Cup clash between Scotland and England really has come back to the boil in recent years after a long period of English dominance. So, to chat through the recent history of the game, two giants who've played in 17 Calcutta Cups between them, often staring at each other come scrum time. In the blue corner, we've got John Barkley. Hi, John. How's it going?
Good, thanks, Will. How are you doing?
Yeah, very good. Looking forward to Saturday. And in the white corner is a new friend of the Times, Courtney Laws. How are you enjoying being a esteemed writer as well as a player, Courtney?
Yeah, it's different. Definitely different, but nah, it's all good fun.
Yeah, absolutely. So look, awesome to have you both on, gents, for this extra ruck ahead of Saturday's game. We're going to talk through some memories, stuff that you guys... games you played in and remember, but let's start with John first as the host, I suppose. How are you feeling ahead of Saturday?
I don't really know, to be honest. It's a strange one, and I'm sure we'll get into it. These were always, and we'll get into sort of memories, I guess, a bit later, but I didn't have many particularly happy memories, so I'm always kind of scathed and scorned and marked by that. But yeah, I think like recent history and, you know, five last six Scotland have held the Calcutta Cup. So it feels a bit more, I don't want to say comfortable, but I also know, you know, I went through a lot of that pain in the sort of the decade before that. So, you know, I set up this generation arguably, but quite enough to laugh so hard there. But yeah, it's I think a bit frustrated probably with the France game, and it would have been, you know, how exciting would it have been to have, you know, two unbeaten sides in Six Nations going at it. That's not really transpired. But I think, yeah, sort of cautious optimism.
Yeah. Courtney, do you have any little pangs this week now that you're retired from internationals, wishing you were still involved in a punchy week like this?
I think you always miss that side of it, like the playing side, being with the boys, being in the mix and kind of in the thick of it, and, you know, going up to what is really a tough place to win now. They're definitely the bits you do miss, but at the same time, all the stuff that goes with it, you know, the meetings, the press, the training. Nah, I'll miss that part.
You love the press, really. Come on, you're part of it now.
Yeah, it's all in there, yeah.
So, well, as we said, we'll run through some of your games and maybe some of the more recent ones as well. But just to get some sort of, like, Calcutta Cup first memories of watching him playing, John, do you remember when you would have first sat down as a boy on the sofa and tune into one of them, or one that particularly caught you as a kid?
I was in the stadium in 2000, and I forget the year now. It must have been 2000, was it 2000 maybe, when Andy Nicol was the captain?
Yes, yeah.
So I was one of the pitch invaders at the end of the game.
Okay.
In a Scotland shirt, kind of running on 14 years old, and that hysteria around that. And I think, yeah, probably watched it for years before that, and it hadn't been sort of happy watching as a Scotsman. But yeah, that would probably be my very first, like, tangible memory of watching a game. And maybe I've just erased all the miserable ones before that, but the joy potentially of being there. And, you know, those games were quite iconic back then, and they still are. but probably more so then because it was quite sporadic as to when Scotland would get their hands on that trophy again.
Yeah, yeah. I suppose maybe in those days that the Scottish victories were really driven on emotion and sort of sticking one on the English, whereas these days it's Scotland have become such a, I don't know, challenging team to play against that it's less on that kind of heart and soul and more on they're just a quality team.
Yeah, I think so. And you look back at those, in particular those games in 2000 and then look back at 2008, I think it was, or 2008, and they were really scrappy. You know, that was probably the framework which Scotland would win in those games back then, like really scrappy, turgid, wet weather, all that sort of stuff. And Scotland probably thrived in those conditions then, whereas you compare that to now and it's the style of play has completely changed. And Scott people are probably talking more about Scotland's attack than anything else. So yeah, they were pretty scrappy games back when I was playing. I guess 2018 probably being the exception.
Yeah, yeah. So just to mark those, April the 2nd, 2000, at Murrayfield, 19-13. And then the 08, 15-9. So as you say, there was an 06 one in there, actually, a Murrayfield win, 18-12. So tight, tense. Courtney, yeah. What about you? Were you the sort of guy that would watch the big Six Nations games or Five Nations games as a kid, or did you just kind of leave it to when you were playing for your biggest memories?
Mate, I honestly, I didn't even know what rugby was until probably 2002, 2003. I still didn't really watch rugby, until I started playing. And then by the time I was kind of 20, I was in the mix, so I was involved in them. So most of my memories are from playing there, to be honest.
Yeah. So talk us through that experience of being an English player going to Scotland, and I guess it's changed over the decade or so that you played in those games. And like, how different is it to Ireland or Wales? Because wherever England go, there's a sort of animosity thing, isn't it? But what's different about Murrayfield and Scotland for an Englishman?
Yeah, it's a very hostile crowd, to be honest. There's not even as an Englishman, and we know we're not very well liked by a lot of nations, to be honest. But there's not many stadiums you turn up at and you get booed. But Scotland is one of them. So for me, I always quite enjoyed it, actually, because it fires you up a bit, to be honest, when you get off the bus and people are booing you and you're like, right, okay, I see how it is, kind of thing. So so there is that aspect. And then obviously... It, as you said, it has changed throughout the years, but one thing you can guarantee is it's going to be crap weather.
It's going to be nice on Saturday. It's actually sunny on Saturday.
Is that right?
Apparently.
I don't think I've ever played there and it's not rained, like genuinely. So it's always, even when the teams are not necessarily as close in form or you know, ability, it's always a relatively close game just because, you know, there's all sorts of different factors involved, one of them being the weather, to be honest.
Yeah. So I've heard that, well, just by the dint of the stadium. So Cardiff, obviously, you come down Westgate Street and you turn in and then you're underground, basically, aren't you, in the stadium?
Yeah.
So you maybe don't get that visceral reaction to the crowd, but Murrayfield's different.
Get banging on the bus and eggs thrown at you and stuff.
Yeah. they get piped in. I remember I spoke to Chris Robshaw about this, and he thought we just did it for the English team to slip because it's a really slow drive. It's about five. And as a player, I remember thinking, can we just get off his bus and walk? Because I want to get in the change room, and it was always a rush. And he thought we just did it to you guys to piss you off, but everyone gets piped in slowly, and it takes forever. I guess we weren't getting eggs thrown at us, so.
And then I've heard about when the doors open, especially if you're in the England coach, you just get hit by this kind of wall of boos. Is that about right?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, you step off the bus and you're surrounded by Scotland fans booing you. Yeah, it's good crack.
Any particular sledges you've heard over the years that made you laugh?
No. You don't hear them. I mean, there's so much being yelled at you, you can't really distinguish what they're saying, but you just hear noise and people generally disgruntled, you know, that you're even there.
Why have you turned up?
Why have you turned up? But yeah, it's all good fun. It's part and parcel of it, and it's why it's such a great place to go and play.
Yeah. So stay with you, Courtney. Let's look at your Calcutta Cup record, which is pretty good. Played 10, won 7, lost 2. Weren't involved in the 2019 draw, 22 or 23. And you've had one of the was a World Cup game in Auckland, 2011, so obviously slightly different. But so if you go back to the start of your days playing Scotland, it must have been quite different because England were kind of always expected to win, really. So how did you guys approach that game then when it was sort of almost the pressure of not being the first one to lose for a while?
Yeah, I mean, it makes it no easier, to be honest, when you're the favourite, because you've got the pressure of being the favourite on you. Again, as well as knowing that regardless of how well informed you are and how much ability you've got, it's often a wet game and you're English playing away from home against, a nation that have been brought up to not like you, including the players who are going to be extremely fired up for it, always closes that gap significantly. So most of the games I've played at Scotland have been really close, one or two scores. Regardless, again, of whether it's early in the career, and obviously now being a lot harder to go and win there, it's always a tough place to go, and it's generally really close.
Was it a place that maybe didn't hold any fear for an English player just because of that record? Like, I was looking from the famous game in 1990, the David Soule, the slow walkout, the Piper on the roof, the poll tax, Thatcher, everything else, to that 2018 game, which you were both involved in. There were 29 Calcutta Cups. In England won 25 of them. Scotland 3, 1 draw. So there was that kind of weight in history in your favour that maybe meant that a Murrayfield trip wasn't that daunting. Is that fair?
Especially in the kind of early years, I'd say that you were very much expected, and even if it was, a bit of a dogfight, you back yourself to still, still turn them over kind of thing. But yeah, obviously that changed in a bit of an instant. I did play in that game. When was it? 2018, I think. Mm. Was that the one where Finn chucked them a couple of passes?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Which really has kind of turned the tide over the last kind of 5-6 years, and the generation of players they've had coming through since then have been really, good players. So they've just kind of been on the up and up, and it's they've been beating us at home as well as away. So that was kind of the biggest one, that 2018 win, probably.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we'll get into that one in detail in a sec. So because John, that was your win. I'm looking at your record: played 7, won 1, drawn 1. But looking at your sort of early days of that history, you mentioned it at the top, but without dragging out too many bad memories, what was it about those England games that you couldn't get over the line maybe in the early days?
They were just much better than us.
Simple as that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, they were a team. I mean, you go back, I started playing 2007. Obviously, England got to the final of the World Cup. Fire on it. And I just think there was a difference of style. Scottish rugby was probably struggling for quality then. And everyone, we talk a little bit about this kind of generation that's gone through, and what's coming behind it is probably the concern. So yeah, my memories weren't fantastic. It was my first Six Nations 2008, and we lost the two first games, my first Six Nations, and I, weekend off, went out of, Evans had to have a quiet weekend, and I went to a friend's house, like had some dinner, and someone at the end, very end of the night, someone sat on my hand, had a glass of wine, and it crushed through my hand and sliced everything open. So I missed the 2008 game, and people still think I was on the piss that night, and I wasn't. And so I watched that game outside. I mean, I was 25th man, 24th man, whatever, 23rd man, whatever it was back then. And I'm standing in the pouring rain outside Murrayfield, kind of waiting for my missus to pick me up and take me home. And I watched it on TV at home, delighted that Scotland won, but also knowing that I should have been part of that game.
Yeah.
So then I didn't know then that we'd have to wait, another 10 years to get a win at that point.
Yeah, wow. So you absolutely, I must have been desperate watching it. But so do you actually have bad memories of that win, even though it was a good win kind of thing, because of the circumstances?
A little bit. I think at the time when you're young and you're just desperate and your personal pride and disappointment was like so visceral. But to be honest, that was another game, and I touched on it earlier. It was a scrappy game, raining, Jason White. I know Jason White, a couple massive instances on Paul Sackey and another big hit. And it was just that kind of game, a few key moments and Scotland go ahead. So again, there were probably games where I remember being in that team back then and didn't really feel like we were going to win. That sounds really pessimistic, but we always went to games hoping to win. Whereas I think now there's probably a bit more expectation, and sometimes people say, you know, Scotland will get ahead of themselves. I think Scotland, the player is certainly very realistic. We've been burned too many times to get too carried away, but there's a bit more optimism, just probably around the style of play and the players they have to actually be competitive.
Yeah, yeah. It's always something that's said about Ireland way back, which has changed over the years, and Wales a bit more recently, of it was sort of, that's the one to win kind of thing, the England game, and nothing else matters, which is obviously a bit reductive. But was that almost genuinely the feeling in those sort of mid-noughties kind of times, because you guys didn't win lots of Calcutta Cups?
Maybe for fans, potentially. Yeah. It was that, partisan kind of pride and, you know, that kind of animosity towards England coming up. And there was that feeling. I remember as a player, you're never happy to win one game. And I remember just being kind of fed up with, you know, for a number of years that we just weren't getting better. So I think players are always going to, they want to win more. But I think at the time we were just not a good enough side to be competitive, capable of big wins every so often, but not capable of stringing them together. And that's always, even now still, is the challenge of how do you string together, you know, like Ireland 18 games in a row, or France 19 games in a row, England, you guys did it in 2021, I think. You know, that's the challenge, and that's a monumental one.
Yeah, yeah. So let's spool forward a bit. We'll get to 18, but I want to deal with 17 first, which is a good day for Courtney and a bad one from John. Big smile, Courtney. So, I mean, 61-21, England rampant, Jonathan Joseph hat-trick, England equal the record, 18 wins in a row. Start with you, Courtney. Like, that's one of the great days, isn't it, for an England player to just to do that to a rival?
Yeah. No, that was a really good day. And yeah, that was like, you know, what do you really say? Pretty much everything we did came up. So, I mean, I think we scored 3 or 4 tries from first phase. And you know, ends up being a walk in the park, to be honest. So yeah, you're just quite happy, and you don't often get them in test matches, especially towards, you know, after 2016-17, it all started to become pretty close. So yeah, we were quite happy with that.
Was that kind of, on the flip side, John, the absolute nadir? Because like from then it has completely changed, hasn't it? Was there any kind of, I don't know, you'd think of the Hollywood film moment of like everyone having a sip of a beer and going, right, this is never happening again. Was it actually like that, or was it just a pretty depressed dressing room at Twickenham?
Oh, it was awful, yeah. That was my second game as captain. We beat Wales the game before, and we probably the start of starting to play a better, more consistent brand of rugby. And I remember Vern Cotter the morning, and he was a straight shooter, you know, didn't hold any sort of said. We had a team walk, and he said to me, this doesn't feel right. And I was like, it doesn't feel right at all in the morning. And the guys were very, just like too relaxed, I thought, and too almost jovial. And that doesn't necessarily matter. Maybe, you know, that happens and you go on and play well. It's easy to say now, but you know, like Courtney says, I remember it was 20. Yeah, I was captain. I'm like, how do you turn this around? And we were 28-0 down, and they all came from first phase. So I'm not trying to absolve myself of any of the responsibility, but I didn't miss those tackles. Do you know what I mean? It was like, they scored again, one of the sticks again. It was 28-0, and it was like 20 minutes or something, wasn't it? And the game was done, dusted. And then, you know, everyone's swing low, and I was like, this is an absolute mare. And you had to endure another 60 minutes of that. I think he scored a couple of tries later on, but it didn't matter. That was pretty single-handedly the most disappointed I've ever been. Because I was the second game as captain, sat with Greg Laidlaw after us. I was like, this can't happen again, kind of thing. And you know, luckily, I played him one more, I think, which was 2018. But yeah, that 17 game, my missus goes to, she's been to the games over the years, and she's very emotionally detached from the game. And my missus cried after that game. So,
wow.
It was that painful. It was just bleak coming out to Scotland, and you know, the stuff before, and everyone thought, oh, we played well against Wales and we'd beaten Ireland in the first game. So that was the, you know, a triple crown. And it was just a, you know, it was embarrassing. It was one of the, I think that was the main emotion, was probably for me, was just real embarrassment that I'd been part of something like that.
Yeah. So did it take coming back for the next Six Nations for that kind of line of sand to be drawn, or was it kind of done that night, as you were saying with Greg Laidlaw sitting there being like, we cannot do this again?
I probably simmered on that for a year. Didn't know if I'd get another chance, and then was captain the following year. And it's one of those things in games that there's a bit of sledging and there's a bit of crack always, but you remember more in games like that. So I kind of stewed on that for a little while, and it was probably one of the more emotional changing rooms I'd been involved with, because it's quite, you see on Netflix, it's pretty chilled out before a game now. There's no one sort of banging chests, and you know, but that was probably a set aside from that, where there was a bit more, just the kind of pain and embarrassment that had kind of been fueled. And there was probably 10 or so guys that played at Twickenham in 2017 that then played the following year. So it definitely felt like I don't believe that you get revenge because you don't get to play the game again, but it definitely felt there was a lingering kind of like real disappointment. This is a chance to maybe set part of that right.
Yeah. Was there an aftermath function, guys? Were you aware, yeah, Courtney, that you'd really sort of hit them in the soul as well as on the scoreboard?
No, I wouldn't say so. Like, maybe it's just me as a player, but I kind of just try to take each game as it comes. And from that part of my career, I was just trying to really enjoy my rugby. So I was just happy to be part of that game, to had a decent influence on the game as well. So, we don't hold quite the same resentment for Scotland as they do for us, so we weren't.
Well, definitely did.
So I wasn't bothered about rubbing in or anything like that.
But did you, John, like, teams love sort of inventing grievances over the years, it's been a historical thing, but you suppose you didn't need to there, but were there things that happened in that 17 game where you thought, right, payback time in 2018, or was it not quite as sort of?
No, it wasn't. It was stronger than a humbling. It was, you know, humiliation. So I think if you don't take a bit of that personally, you know, something's probably wrong. And I think any, whether it's England or Wales, or if you put 60 points on you, yeah, I think I probably felt it more as captain. My second year as captain, and I did a post-match function. I think it was Joe Marler's 50th cap, and I had to go on stage and speak and try and be a kind of stoic loser, which I tried to be. But you can imagine that you just don't want to feel like that again. I certainly didn't. So I don't think there was any kind of, it wasn't really spoken about in the week before. I think it was probably just more just personally, you know, people felt like they had to, you know, do some making up for, you know, themselves and the team a little bit. But you're right, you don't get to necessarily get that one back. It was gone, and it doesn't erase 2017. I don't even think 2018 made up for it.
No. Okay. So the story goes that we know about Ryan Wilson and the scrap in the tunnel, which we'll get to. But the story goes that the sort of seed was planted a few months before at the World Rugby Awards, where he was piling into a couple of sherbets and getting into England to winning awards at that ceremony and whispering sweet nothings into Eddie Jones's ear. Is that about right?
I wasn't there. I know Finn Russell organised a private jet over, and they told their missus that their girlfriends weren't allowed to come, but they brought Ryan and someone else as their plus ones.
It was Stuart Hogg and Finn Russell with Ali Price and Ryan Wilson, I think. It was the plus
one. That sounds about right. Yeah, there was just been a bit of chat about that. It wouldn't surprise me, put it that way.
Yeah. Was he, I don't know, because he's become famous for that little scrap and stuff for that. And did it genuinely have an effect on your side, John, that there was a bit of a, like, you're not coming up here and having one for free?
I didn't know what happened. So I had no idea. I always liked to get first. I would always run into the changing room afterwards and always imagine I wanted to be that captain that would be in the middle of it. You know, see those, I grew up, you know, watching Patrick Vieira and Roy Keane in the tunnel, and, you know, I was in the bogs when that happened. So I missed it all. And genuinely, after the match, and the journalists says, you know, what impact did that have? And I had no idea, and I wasn't the only one. So it's only after you saw, again, it's easy to, you know, it's post hoc, you know, narrative that this was a sign. Ryan just is that, he always has been that kind of player, likes to annoy. He still is annoying. One of my best mates, he just wants to annoy people. And he got under Oldfield's skin that day, and I don't think it had an impact on the game. Oldfield's, you know, far too smooth an operator to, you know, let something like that influence something that happens, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 minutes later.
Yeah. Were you around for it, Courtney? You're not a man whose feathers are ruffled off, are you?
No, I didn't. I didn't see it at all. I didn't know it happened either, to be honest. I don't know if I was... I must have gotten in before it kicked up. I'd like to be involved in it, actually, yeah, to be honest. But,
might have finished sooner.
I don't mind a good scrap, so yeah, it would have been right in my alley. But no, unfortunately, I missed out as well.
Was there, from your perspective, Courtney, was there something different maybe about Scotland that day? Or do you just think it was one of those where they got it right, you got a couple of things wrong? There was actually a try disallowed that may have been given for Danny Kerr. He always maintains that he should have... have one, shouldn't he? Like, what was different about that game for you in 18?
Was that the one? The one got disallowed because I shot out of the line and hit someone tonight, but he said I'm not.
Yeah. It was Joe Launchbury fiddling around in a ruck as well. A little knock on them.
Yeah, it was that one. I don't know. They all kind of joined together over the years, but I remember that game just. It was a really competitive game and it was really close. And then a few things like Finn was obviously just starting to find himself really as a player, I think, especially for Scotland. And he made a couple of pretty outrageous plays, as well as us underperforming in terms of, you know, just simple one-on-one tapping and stuff like that. And that's a test match at the end of the day. And you know, we were obviously really disappointed. We went into the game heavy favourites. To end up losing that was incredibly disappointing because we should have done better, honestly. But, Scotland were better than us on the day, and that's what counts.
Yeah. John, you can take us away on the Finn pass if you want.
Again, I was chatting to someone about this earlier this week, and I feel like I was playing a different, and I feel like I must have played a different sport because he threw that pass and I was shouting, "Don't throw the pass." So I saw what was in front of me. That was the kind of the zone I played within. You know, Finn's corner touched in it. He's probably starting to find himself then, and since went to Racing and back to Bath and really established himself. So, as well as I didn't actually realize how good a pass it was until afterwards. And you see on the spider camera above the overhead one, it's a pretty. Yeah, a pretty bold pass to throw in your 22, and that's the kind of player he was. But yeah, I'm similar to Scott. I don't have huge. It all does kind of blur into. I remember that moment and the try that came off it, and Hugh Jones scored a good one under the post. I guess Hugh probably one of the better games that Hugh played. Scored two tries that day actually. It was kind of, it was still a tight, you know, Emerson, it was a big Scotland. It was still tight right at the end. But yeah, it was typical. I think it wasn't that wet that day. Slightly drizzly, maybe.
Yeah.
Do you remember, because John, the other bit of it was that you and Hamish Watson had loads of joy at the breakdown. You're on the right side of Nigel Owens. Was that a concerted plan for that week of just going hammer and tongs at jackling and getting the breakdown? I mean, it's always important, isn't it? But was there a particular plan that week to go for it?
No more so than normal. I think, I don't remember, were you in the back row out there, Courtney? I don't remember.
Yeah, I was playing six, yeah.
Chris Robshaw was at seven, who was at eight?
Nathan Hughes, I think.
It was Nathan. So I think there was a bit of chat from Vern before that it might be Chris Robshaw moved to play a bit more blind side. There might be a bit more opportunity on the floor today, and the way Nigel was refereeing the game at the time, there was a bit of room for playing in there, and I think we probably got, there was a couple like in our 22, and that's, you quite touched on it, the fine margins, you know, a couple of scrums England had in our 22, and we get turnovers, and the turnover that came before that led to Finn Russell's pass as well. So, you know, different referee, different day, potentially, you know, small margins, and you don't get those turnovers. So there was a, I guess to answer your question, there was a thought that maybe there would be a bit more space on the ground, but also, you know, I've been involved a number of times where you think that and you're getting smoked all over the place and you make bad decisions and you really sell yourself short and end up being defensively quite shy. So it worked that day. I guess that's the only way I could answer it.
Yeah. With both of you, you must have had opponents you've had over your career where you've had a long run of not being able to beat them, but then you get the first one. Is there something in like, it's obvious, I suppose, but the belief you get from getting the first one that then bleed into the other matches. I don't know, Courtney, whether you found that with maybe the All Blacks or something in the past where you've struggled to beat them for years and then got one and then it leads to two, three.
Well, I think I've only beat the All Blacks twice, so maybe not. Yeah, two or three times, but we've never, I don't think as a team necessarily had that. We've had obviously good wins against everyone, really. But the most blatant one is definitely this kind of, you know, Scotland against us at the minute, whereby, you know, they get that one game, their foot in the door, and then they're just kicking it open kind of thing. So, and they'll definitely, I'm sure you'll speak on this, but you can definitely get a lot of confidence. You know, once you get that win, you understand that we are as good as them. You know, we can beat them. And if we just play our game well, you know, you give yourself a chance rather than going into every game thinking, Jesus, we need to play out of our skin to beat these guys. It just becomes, no, we just need to play well. You know, we just need to do our job, and we've got the ability to beat them.
John, I know that 18 was your last one, but the crazy draw in 19, maybe that plus 2018 sows the sort of double belief, because not just doing it at home, but doing that at Twickenham as well.
Yeah, I blew my Achilles out after that Six Nations and missed the following year. And then, yeah, I was doing a bit of corporate stuff, and I was in a box with Ugo, Austin Healy, and someone else. And I remember thinking, this was, 2017 was bad. This is torture being in this room. But that was a bizarre game. I mean, me and Ugo said, let's just go. We're going to go to the pub. Around the corner, get out, beat the rush. Schumacher had a score by half time. I thought, let's wait for it. And it just, it was a bizarre. I was involved in 2010 against Wales where they went the other way. And it just was a crazy game. And it was actually quite cool, not just as a Scotsman to be in a stadium, and just to feel that kind of that sense of a whole stadium in panic, that kind of rising kind of sense of like, what's going on here? And it kept anything, I can't score again. And it happened, and it was a bonkers game. We end up thinking this could be a humiliation to we've won to we've drawn, but it feels like a loss. I did to your point earlier on, is it like a psychological advantage to beating that team once? I never, maybe a bit of that, but I was maybe my outlook on rugby, I was always like, there needs to be more than that. You need to, one game doesn't make up for that. And I was always keen to try and, double up on that. But it looks like this team now, there's not a fear there. I don't think there was necessarily a fear per se, but there was definitely a sense that these guys are better than us. We need to rely on that emotional side of the game a bit more, as now, I think Gregor Townsend spoke about it last week with Chris Jones, saying like, he was too emotional in that 2019 game, sorry. It's actually not really about that. That's what, Courtney's saying. You take that emotion out of it, and it's actually, if we play our game, and there's lots of things that can go wrong, then I think the Scottish team will believe, and certainly have done in the last 4, 5, 6 years against England there, that they play well. They'll put themselves in contention, certainly.
Yeah, yeah. So, Courtney, the last time England did beat Scotland, 2020, was, you're talking about dodgy weather in Scotland. That was the absolutely worst one ever, wasn't it? Storm Ciara and everything else. But that was a proper sort of get out, get the job done, get home, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. That was was that the one Genji scored right at the end?
Yeah, 13-6 in a horrendous movie.
Yeah, nightmare. so that was, I think, that was my last game at Murrayfield. So, I went out on a win, I'll tell you that. tough game.
Is there something, like Ben Earl was speaking about this with us the other day, maybe there's a blueprint in there of that's possibly how you have to shut down the game at Murray for these days, like with the team that they've got? I know the weather conditions were brutal then, but do you think there's seeds in that for how England can do it this weekend?
No, I don't like, if it's going to be a dry day as well, what we can do, not pass the ball, just try and pick and go.
Just pick and go more.
Pick and go from the halfway line. No, I think England have everything they need to beat Scotland. Like, yes, Scotland are a good team. Yes, they're in form. But we want, yes, we are a good enough team to beat them. It's not, we're not, you know, a significantly better team, you know, than them as we were in the past, but that doesn't matter. Everybody's good nowadays. You're going to have to go out there and earn every game, every win. And if you go out there and earn it, then you know, you get yourself in position to win the game. So, you know, they need to believe that in the game plan. And back themselves.
Yeah. So, John, obviously 21 first win at Twickenham is 83, no fans, but did it with fans in 2023. Finn Russell's cross kicks in 2022, Callum Dickey volleyballing one into touch kind of helped in that one, didn't it? What have been the keys, do you think, to the recent Scottish run? I think if they win another one, it'll be the first time they've beaten England four times in a row since the 70s, 1970 to 72. So it's historic stuff they're aiming for this weekend.
I mean, yeah, certainly last year was, again, another game that could have gone either way, really, if you look at it. And probably the moments that have separated the teams since 2018 is probably just little moments of individual magic. And I think that's what you see in the top test matches now. They're so organised, so disciplined. You assume that's a level playing field that is in the day. You need something to break it up. In 2018, it was, you know, Finn Russell. You look at last year, you know, that Duan van der Merwe try. You don't see many tries like that kicking around, you know. And that's kind of what, that's probably it. I think Scotland have probably brought in a few guys that can bring in that X factor and moments, big moments in a game. But it's no surprise. It's always the same. You know, Finn Russell plays well. Scotland generally play well. And you could say that almost about every team, but probably more so with Scotland, given just how good I think he is and how important he is to the team. He plays well, which a lot of things have to go into that. Scotland generally.
We'll get Courtney's other take on this in a second. But John, what would you expect the Scottish psyche to be this week with England coming and the like rank disappointment of that TMO decision at the end of the France game?
I hope it galvanises them a bit. I wouldn't imagine they'll be feeling sorry for themselves. I think that'd be the great thing about that those fallow weeks is the emotional roller coaster of the Six Nations, you know, it can be quite quickly over before you realise. But that gap week probably happened at a good time just to park that emotional disappointment and get the frustration out because it's gone and you can't piss and moan, you know, for eternity as much as we'd like up in Scotland. But it's I think they'll be in a pretty good headspace. I think you look at some of the rugby they played the first half against France. It was a terrible second half with the kick battle and the way the game went. But the players of Gustav managed to be a lot more disciplined against France. And I think they'll be pretty content. The style of play has, I think, evolved for the better since the World Cup. It had to. They're becoming too predictable, but they seem to have learned the lessons. So I think they'll be kind of confident, but also, you know, England went to a World Cup and did well, also coming off two wins. So, it's always the same. You know, you're aware of the size of the challenge coming, but also probably nothing they will be fearing that England side, just because they'll have taken a bit of confidence from the first couple of rounds.
Yeah. Courtney, take us into the mindset of the English players this week. Would this sort of recent run in history be mentioned? Would it be talked about and sort of rattled around the team rooms?
I'm sure it'll be mentioned. I don't think it'll be harped on about, or, you know, we're not going to kind of hang our boots on that. But, you know, you have to mention, you know, the past and the fact that, you know, we need to go and win. Is the fact of the matter. And kind of on top of that, in terms of, you know, talking about Finn and stuff, I don't know if a team in international rugby, maybe not dependent is the right word, but has integrated any single player into their game plan more than Scotland have done with Finn. Like, he is so integral to what they do. And that's not to say the players around him aren't very good players, and they are. They've got a lot of good players, if not world-class players in their team now. But his ability to, you know, bring the best out of them as a leader now, give them the opportunities they need, especially in terms of their back line and stuff like that, and then get out of the forwards what he needs out of them, is what kind of makes them such a massive threat. And I think if they had somebody else at 10, they'd struggle a lot more. So if I was England, I'd go after Finn. I know that.
In short, yeah. So if you're still in England's back row, Courtney, how are you getting about that? Because I suppose there's always the balance between putting too many eggs in the Finn basket, I suppose, and if he's got that wonder play in him, you're left exposed. So how would you be approaching it if you were in the team still?
Well, yeah, of course you can't just be gunning for one man. You need, we're going to need to defend very cohesively. You know, we're going to need to be very connected. Otherwise, he's gonna pick us apart. But what we can't do is give him time to play. If we give him time to play and do what he wants to do, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. So, you know, whatever you can do, get in his face. If you get a chance, put a shot on him. You know, try and get in his head. It's quite hard with Finn because he's quite a relaxed bloke. He doesn't take it all too seriously, which actually, you know, goes in his favour when you're talking about stuff like this and trying to rattle people. But as much as we can disrupt his game, the better, kind of thing. But at the same time, you know, we can't put ourselves in a vulnerable position to do that.
And is it actions as well as words as well when you're trying to get into someone's pocket, into someone's head?
Yeah, it's actually more than words. That's what I'm saying. Like, if you get a shot on him, put him down, hold him there if you need to. Don't be stupid, give him away penalties or anything like that, but if you can disrupt him in any way, shape or form, do it. You know, it's all part of the game.
Who can you see in that? I mean, there's plenty of people, but particularly would you pick out of that England pack who's going to quite relish this challenge of doing that job?
I think Benioe, Unders, Chez probably are good players out the pack to go and do that, all because they're very quick. I know Chez is big, but he's a quick man, so they will be able to get to him, and they're also got really good engines. They'll be able to just get up, do it again, and it's going to be a big breakdown battle as well, because if he gets quick ball, he's going to be dangerous. So we're going to need, you know, players in our full pack to really step up this game.
Yeah, John, it's always no Finn, no fun, isn't it? But he's going to love this, isn't he? Everyone kind of... Does he would relish the fact that England are trying to get after him and stuff like that, and takes the ref from the swoo?
I don't assume that's any different to every team playing against him.
Yeah.
That's the thing about defense, like, and Courtney touched on it, you make it a personal thing, defense. If you do that, you know, the systems and cohesion that you jeopardise. So the way England are defending now, obviously a lot more aggressively getting off the line and giving space out wide. There's not going to be as much space through the middle. He's one of those characters, like Quinn said again, that he's so aloof, and you saw it in that Netflix documentary. He's you know, Farrell got after him, and it doesn't really faze him. He seems to be super relaxed and plays his own game. So, yeah, he'll be aware of it. They'll talk a lot about the challenge and what's coming, and more and more line speed, more pressure on him, I think. And I think probably certainly the last 12 months, someone like Sione Tupiloftu has arguably become as important, just because the space he gives Finn makes Scotland less predictable, because he carries the ball, you know, like a bull, but also they've got structures in place that allow him to give Finn space on the ball. So I think there's some kind of cute strategic technical stuff that Scotland have done to free Finn up. You saw a couple of moments against Wales as well, sweeping back against the blind. There's ways you can take a bit of pressure off, but yeah, they're going to be coming after Finn.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, should we round up with some predictions, lads? Makes for a tasty one. Courtney, start with you. Only one place to go.
Well, I don't know. This was Tom Enterprise. I think it's going to be a high-scoring game, actually.
Okay.
So I'm going to go 32-25 England.
Oh, belter. What a game. John? It's never usually that much at Murrayfield, is it? 50-odd points.
It's meant to be 8 degrees, which is summer here, which would be nice. And I think it's going to be Scotland 27, England 19.
Okay. So both going for not actually nippers. I think no one cares about what I think, but I think it's going to be a very tight one. But let's see. Pleasure to have both of you on the pod today, lads. Really appreciate it. And for everyone listening, you can read both of these guys in the Times coming up over the next few days and all through the tournament. Courtney, awesome to have you on. Thanks for coming, mate.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
John, too, brilliant stuff as always. Thank you. You're going to be there doing the telly stuff, aren't you, on Saturday?
Yeah, I'll be there. Good snacks for the BBC.
Happy days. Well, thanks for sharing your memories, lads, and all the best of the weekend.
Cheers, John.
Awesome there to have the thoughts and memories of Courtney Laws and John Barclay, two esteemed Times columnists, which, as I said, you can read in the week and all through the Six Nations. It's almost here, Calcutta Cup on Saturday with the rest of the Six Nations action. And On the Ruck, we'll be back to talk through it all on Monday. But for now, thanks for listening and enjoy the weekend's rugby.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.